Welcome to the Appen Appen Podcast, the podcast of people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysappen, work in a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And we're back, or should I say I'm back as well, because I missed last week. It was my son's birthday, so we couldn't get back in time. But Jerry and Al were here to keep everyone entertained. That was episode 11. This is episode 12. And how are we all going on? And what have we got in store for tonight?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. Got some more Linuxy stuff for you, hopefully.
Good. I'm all right. I've got some. I want to go over through some domain stuff. I should have asked for you. Have you got a pen and paper with you in front of you? Have you got any pen and paper?
I've got a big box of tub of pencils. most of them are colouring pencils, though.
So. And a bit of paper. We'll do some drawing in a little while. So yeah. So I've been kind of working. Well, two things I'm doing this week. Office 365 again. I've been doing another migration. Found a couple of things out this week with it. That Office 365 is a limit that you can only have 25 megabyte file attachments. So it's not too much of a problem if after the migration, but if people have got bigger mails in their inboxes, so if someone sent them an email or something, or they get some people who like store their documents in their Outlook or whatever, these will not get transferred across, and there's kind of no way of transferring them to Office 365. It's like a limit for a limit. So
does it block the mail, or does it block the whole mailbox, or
if mail coming in, it won't let the email come in because the limit is 25 meg, but with SMTP it actually puts stuff on top of it, so it's actually something like a 16 meg file size limit. But the problem I've got is, like, we're using a software called Code2. It's quite a cool bit of software. And currently running Exchange 2010, and they're going to Office 365. And because their infrastructure they've got, we can't do a straight migration. You basically have a bit of software you install on the PC, and it basically speaks to Office 365 and Office 2010. And it will basically, in the background, it starts migrating stuff from one system to the other. So you give it your Office 2010 username and password for Exchange server and your Office 365 password, and it basically just copies the mail between the two. And once it's in your initial sync, you can then set it to sync up every night or something like until you get everyone migrated across. But the problem you've got is that if people have got mail in their existing mailbox, which is like with a lot of people do, like big files or big, this has got a lot of graphics in it, those files, those emails won't get copied across. So just something to watch out for if people do an Office 365 migration. So
I found that, I mean, in my day job, people are often, sending huge attachments. And I know when I used to do Linux mail servers a long time ago, when I was just learning, Linux admins used to be tearing their hair out, people sending around attachments. This was before the advent of social networks, so where people would just send, pictures or, bitmaps around to each other and things like that. So, and there wasn't the space for it on the mail server, especially those days.
So again, with the Office migration I've been doing kind of a... Annoyingly... In Exchange 2003, you can go to the view and it'll show you how big people's mailboxes are and what the last time they logged on. But in 2010, there's no way of going in the GUI to find that. But I found a nice little PowerShell which I'll put in the show notes, which basically you can run. It basically pulls out all the mailboxes, who owns them, when it's last logged on, and the size of it. So it's a nice little PowerShell script. So I'll put that into the basically exports to a CSV file, and you can then obviously open it in Excel and you can do whatever you want with it. So, and also with Office 365, I've told you before, some of the accounts you actually get the actual the Office kind of with it. You get the latest version of Office with it. But this client had already got, didn't want to do this, so they basically just used whatever Office client they already had. And they're basically, Office 365 has kind of dropped the support for Office 2007 now. And they were only support, a long time ago, they just said like you had to be like a certain service pack. But their documentation on their website says that it basically, Office 365 is designed to work with any version of Microsoft Office that is in mainstream support. So mainstream support means that the latest service pack. So basically, 2010 and Service Pack 3 is supported until October the 13th, 2015, or Office 2013 Service Pack 1 with that's supported until April 10th, 2018. But I've been speaking to a couple of people online on Yammer, and they said that if you phone up Microsoft, they always say you've got to have the latest CU update on it, but if you've got a problem. But most people say just if you have, make sure you've got 2010 SP3 installed and 2013 SP1 installed. So what have you been up to, Jerry or Andy? Anything good this week? Or
I've had nothing in I've got some things that is coming up next week in one of the youth clubs that I do work on. So that's coming up next week. So that's setting up the, I think we mentioned it before actually, but they're ready to get setting up of the updates and the backup on the Windows server. In fact, I was down there today putting in, I've got a 2 terabyte USB 3 hard drive which I've plugged in, which is ready to go for doing its backups. So hopefully I'm going to make a start on that on Monday. And as opposed to this week, I had one of those customers this week. he got, and I haven't seen this for a while actually, but he got the police ransomware virus. I haven't seen it for a good 6 months or so, maybe more, and he got it. But I mean, he was upset that he got it in the first place. But he was the way he was a bit unbelievable, really. He phoned me up and asked me how does he get rid of it, as if I'm going to tell him what to do, you know. Plus the fact you can't just explain it, can you? This guy knows a little bit, but not a lot. And he said, "Where do I go to get rid of it?" You know. He said, because when the computer boots up, it just goes to the ransomware screen, you know, that, and you can't, he says, you can't click on anything, you can't do this, you can't do that, so where do I go to get rid of it? And he was basically trying to ask me how to do it. Apart from the fact it's pretty difficult to explain for someone who doesn't got a clue anyway, but am I going to tell him how to fix it? And he eventually said, well, I'll have to come round and have a look. So by the time I got round there, he was actually saying to me, he said, this is ridiculous. Surely someone should invent something that when something goes wrong, and this is a classic, this, right? When something goes wrong, there's just a button you can click that fixes it. I said, yeah, so that would be great, wouldn't it? He said, well, surely Microsoft can do something like that. He said, well, he said that he shouldn't, he reckoned he'd never get infected because he's got AVG-free installed. And because he's got AVG-free installed, he'll never get infected. I said, oh no, he said, you can get infected, anyone can get infected, you know. And he said, but that should block it, shouldn't it? Well, it could do, if it knew about it, it would block it, but no, it hasn't, obviously. So he was saying, well, what can I do to get rid of it? I said, well, it's probably in a hidden directory. There'd be registry keys that need to be deleted. There'll be all sorts of stuff, you know, we've got to take out. We've got to find it first. And I took, I got rid of it. No problem getting rid of it. And when I took it back, he said, is there anything I can do to stop this from ever happening again? Because this has happened. I've had to call you out. I've had to pay you to get rid of it. But what I want is to never get anything like that ever again. I said, well, there are certain things you can do. I discreetly said, don't you torrent movies and things like that, because I know for a fact he does that, right? I said torrenting stuff and downloading illegal music and illegal videos quite often gives you stuff like this, so I said don't do that. And you could see in his face, he was like, oh right, yeah. And also, I said, oh, and there's various bits of software that you can buy to stop it, you know. One of them's the crypto prevent and things like that, you know. Even the paid version of Malwarebytes can stop things like that. And as soon as I said you can buy stuff that will prevent it, he didn't want to know. So he basically wants to pay nothing. He wanted to never get infected, and he never wants to have to pay someone else to remove it, because he doesn't want to stop downloading movies and he doesn't want to pay for any protection. So so that was a bit of a discussion, should we say, that I had with one of my customers this week. And he was adamant that Windows should produce something that just that you could click a button and it would fix it. So
did he also want the moon on a stick?
God, it was. I mean, you think about it; it's a bit ridiculous, isn't it? Really. He said, "Why can't you produce something like that?" I said, "Well, if everybody had a big red button that said fix on it, then the first thing that these malware writers would do is write a script to disable the big red button that said fix on it, wouldn't it?" You know, it's a bit like, well, how can we get round an antivirus program from detecting us? You know, that's how they write it, so they don't get picked up, so they don't. So it was a bit on you. He's been a bit of a, I've seen him a few times before, he's a bit of a character, but but that was quite amusing. I liked the big red button comment that he come out with. So if anyone out there has got a good idea for making a big red button, then go for it, because he'll buy it for free.
A big marketing thing, wouldn't it? A big red button to basically wipe your PC and start again.
Yeah. If somebody did invent this big red button, he wouldn't want to buy it anyway, because he doesn't want to pay for it. So, so if someone wants to make a big red button for free, he'll buy it from you.
Not much incentive there.
Nah.
All right. Are you up to anything interesting, Jerry?
Doing some stuff at work. We're putting together a load of hardware to send out to a remote site. So that's actually been probably more interesting than the stuff I usually do in my day job. It tends to be supporting applications, and on the freelance side, I've been learning about this thing called cPanel, which is it's like a web front end for your Linux server. Maybe we'll talk about that in a future episode, but it's
I have used cPanel quite a few times.
Okay, it's interesting. It's quite user friendly on the front end, but what it does to the server and behind the scenes is not much fun at all. So I've been doing some stuff with that, but yeah, that's about it for me, really.
So cPanel, do you have to pay for that, or is that something that's free? Or
I believe so. It's just an extra few quid on your monthly your monthly server rental.
Yeah, I think you have to pay for it. I think you do have to. It's not like you can download it for free. I think it's part of the.
Yeah. Now there's another one called Plesk, which I've used more, and it seems to be a lot nicer what it does behind the scenes. I mean, it's not none of these things are perfect, but it gets the job done for, you know, the sort of less experienced user, and it doesn't sort of get its tendrils everywhere in the bit that I'm interested in, you know, the command line stuff. So cPanel's interesting.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
I like all the little extra bits you get on cPanel with, all the software and that you can put on with it.
Yeah, I haven't played around with it much on the front end much, really. I mean, it is quite powerful what it can do, but to do that, it needs to kind of take over your server. The way that it deals with the web server configuration isn't fun at all, because Plesk is much nicer anyway. But command line is best. Command line configuration management software and clever use of regular expressions, much better.
So you've been doing about four loops or something, you were saying.
It was just a bit of a sort of trick you might, you know, your budding Linux admin might want to use in the command line. I won't go through the syntax and everything on the audio, but basically what you can do is on the command line or in a script, but it's kind of tends to be pretty useful on the command line. You can say for each item in the list, do this command. So you can sort of, you can either specify a list of things. They could be file names or whatever, and say for each of these, do a command. So, you know, so for each directory, list the contents of the directory, or for each item, you know, for each. How do I explain it? In Linux, well, I think you have similar in Windows. If you look in the Task Manager, you have a PID, which is process ID. So if you've got some processes that are hanging around that you want to kill, you can say, get all the PIDs of these processes and kill them all. That's an example of usage. I'll put a sort of more detailed explanation in show notes, but
yeah.
It's just a useful way of, rather than going through and doing things one by one, you can use this concept of a for loop, which is kind of a standard programming
language
concept, to get things done more quickly. So I tend to use it quite a lot, I've found, and you can just sort of go into it on the command line, which makes it quite handy. Or you can use it in the script as well. I mean, you can probably get comfortable with it on the command line and then start using it in a script or something like that. So you
could like get a list of files, and if you wanted to change the permissions on all those files, is that what you're saying? So like you could go for each loop.
Yeah, you could do anything you want, like change the permissions, add underscore one to the file name or whatever, or anything you can think of, basically. This is where the flexibility comes in. I mean, you're talking about PowerShell earlier. I mean, it's that sort of thing. You end up doing a lot of that as a Linux admin, a lot of that sort of thing, where you've got a list, you know, a big list, and you've got to pass the list, or you've got a list of files and you need to do something with them. So, yeah, for loops are your friend. So I'll write a little bit about that in the show notes.
Cool. All right, well, my other thing I've been working on is we're moving offices. Well, we've got one big office and we're going into getting rid of a part of it. And I've got to move a load of servers tomorrow. So I'm feeling a bit achy and lachy already on the way home. I had an hour and a half drive home, kind of going to the office today, and it got stuck in a traffic jam for half an hour. And we've basically got to run rack, a load of kit, and then obviously document it, how it's all plugged in, move it down a flight of stairs, and then plug it all back in again. Hopefully making sure that we plug all the cables back into the right holes and stuff. So, but to testing it, we were moving fibre about. So normally you get your Cat 5 cables, you know, on a network card, your cable, you normally see the back of the computer into the switch or whatever. But obviously that can only go up to 100 metres. But with fibre, you can go a lot further. You can go like up to 600 metres, up to like 10 kilometres with a fibre. And there's one that people have been caught out in the past. There's kind of two fiber cables you can get. There's a thing called a single mode cable or a multi mode cable. And someone had found me a 10 meter single mode cable, but I needed a multi mode cable. So you can't use a single mode on a multi mode cable on a multi mode fiber, or and the other way around. So it kind of threw me, and I remembered before I've come across a problem that why this link wasn't coming up when I put this cable in it. It was because I was using a single mode cable on a multi-mode fiber. So multi-mode fiber is what you'd normally get in your offices, where you can go for like up to 600 meters. Whereas a single mode, you can go up to like 10k. I think it's the way it transmits the light. With a single mode, I think it only transmits it one way. And then there's nothing that goes back on that same cable. It goes, because you normally have two cables with fibre, so you have one what transmits and one what receives. And with multi-mode, I think it bounces loads of lights down the tube, but with a single mode, it just sends it straight down the middle, and that's how you can get further.
I think single mode is I think it's polarised. But it's only, which means the wavelengths only go a certain way, and that's why it's, you know, long distance. That's the kind of stuff they put in, they string across the Atlantic and things like that to put the internet, you know, from continent to continent, sort of thing. And yeah, multi-modes, yeah, like you say, many different. I'm not sure if it's wavelengths or. You know, different polarizations, but yeah, there's more information, but it can only travel a shorter distance.
Yeah, I think with the multi-mode, you can use like LEDs or whatever to transmit the data, and that's why the transceivers you get are quite cheap compared to if you want a single mode transceivers, what are very expensive. Cause I think it has to use lasers to get it that far. But as just people remember to order the right cable, basically. That's what I'm just saying, because I spent 10 minutes trying to work out why this cable's not working. I remembered, single mode, multi-mode, because I was doing something for football club and I couldn't work out why this link wasn't coming up. And it was like and we were doing it at the night time because we were replacing their core switches, and I couldn't work it out. And it wasn't until someone said, are you using a single mode or multi-mode? And I was like, well, I don't know the difference between a single mode or a multi-mode cable. So
did they both have two different distances, but did they run at the same speed or the
you can do all the same sort of speed over them, depends what they are. So you can get up to like 40 gig kind, but I think like there's things like OM1, OM2 and OM3, and I think depending what OM rating it is depending what traffic you can, what speed you can send. And like and the thing is that annoyingly the multi-mode and the single mode, they all use the same connector, so you get like the ST or the LC connectors, so they fit nicely on the connector, so you wouldn't know. And normally the single mode is quite a lot thicker cable than what the multi-mode cable is. So
yeah, I was going to say they could at least put different plugs on. That's how I normally get out of trouble.
And I think you can put loads more cores as well, because like I think you get like 8 cores, so you can run one fibre cable, but if you look, it's got 8 strands in it, so that you can then have 4. Then you can have 4 of them, so you can have the transmit and receive them. So, anything else I want to talk about? Or should we go on to my
just on a networking front? The stuff we're putting together. In my day job, 10 gig over Cat 6, I'd never seen that before. It just makes you think that the more time goes on, the more that you're living in the future. So I remember when it was 10 megabit.
Well, I was listening to a podcast on my home, and it was on about software defined networking, SDN, which I still don't really understand yet. And open flow and what that's about. And then the guy was saying that they're kind of hit a limit now. 40 gig is like the limit. They can't get any faster than that. So now they've got to like, and all the hardware is all the same now. So it's all about the software. So I understand it. Do you just go off and buy a switch and then you just put whatever software you want on it. I think that's what the guy was saying on the podcast, but I need to look into that further, I think. So like you just like you want a load balancer on your Switch, you just like buy the bit of software to create a virtual application and it does all the load balancing for you. So
yeah, or write it yourself, or get the open source version that will no doubt exist in 5 years' time. I read about it. It was to do with Google's how Google are doing it, which they're obviously 5 years ahead of everyone else. So it's they've got PhDs looking at it. So, but yeah, it's to do with defining your networks, because networks traditionally sit on the logic sits on the switch or the router, whereas if you can define that and you can it can be responsive to traffic and things like that, and then that's all good.
Yeah, because the thing called OpenFlow, I think, is an open standard, which is what they're kind of trying to get everyone to kind of agree to.
Yeah, that's what I read about OpenFlow, yeah.
I suppose every physical technology, you know, the principles can only be developed so far, can't they? So the things like fibre can only be developed so far. You know, copper cable can only carry data at a certain speed. So in order to make the, you know, you're saying before that they've hit a limit, they'd have to completely redesign technology. It's a bit like processors, you know, processors in computers and that. They were going that fast when they were single core, you know, they were going that fast and that much heat was generated that they couldn't physically go any quicker. So they had to develop all the ways to go quicker and then make it multi-core, dual-core and quad-core and things like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, they've got like 16 cores now, haven't they? The latest Intel processors is just like got six. Because that's why it's virtualization is such a cool, because it can just use all that power.
Yeah. What would you call that then? Because dual is two, quad is for four.
It's like dodecahedron, isn't it?
So we're going to get a dodecahedron core. I can just see that on the next Intel advert.
Hexadecimal, isn't it? Hexadecimal.
Hexi-core.
Yeah. Well, no, that's six, isn't it? So, yeah.
Because the problem with networking is the latency, isn't it? I think it's the problem you get is you can get these speed, but it's the actual latency of it.
I've talked to a couple of people as well about the fact that TCP/IP is quite a big limitation on networking, because it was designed a long time ago for a specific use case, really, which was the US military, and it's the things that it's being used for now, like video streaming, for instance. It just wasn't designed to do. You find that video streaming is limited by the things that other people are using the protocol for. I don't know if anyone else has heard of it, or if any of our listeners have heard of it, but RINA, R-I-N-A, which stands for Recursive Internetwork Architecture, something I've been told about. There isn't a lot of information on the internet, but I'm told it's the next big thing, so you never know.
Well, you heard it here first. Yeah, I thought of something. Because this is obviously to do with latency in equipment that we use, routers, switches and things like that. But you know, with things being fibre optic, right? I mean, what speed does fibre optic run at? It's obviously the speed of light.
The speed of light, yeah.
And you can't go any quicker than that. So why are we all running at 10 meg, you know?
The limitation with routers is the protocol. It's not just TCP/IP, it's things like BGP and whatever the other protocols are, so I can't remember them right now, but the latency comes from the hops that the packet has to do to get to its destination,
and also you've got latency, like if you're getting your packet from America or whatever, that's obviously it's got to cross the Atlantic to get it in like places like Japan and stuff. That's where you get the math. I don't really understand it. I need to look into it, because it's latency, but just means this test takes longer to arrive, doesn't it?
There's a good, I'll put it in the show notes actually, there's a good YouTube channel called Computerphile, P-H-I-L-E, Computerphile, and it does explain that routing thing quite well, so maybe I'll stick that in the show notes.
It's got to be in the hops and in the, you know, in the physical equipment that we use, even your local router, you know, and web services.
I think it's part physical, part protocol, the actual protocol itself, or the protocols that are used.
And that's the thing I was saying the other week about the thing I had with a 10 gig issue with like the MTU size with the jumbo frame, because it can't transmit enough data quick enough. I've been having real fun with VMware. So I haven't solved this 10 terabyte, or sorry, this getting it, hitting this 10 limit on the old Veeam backup. But I have, rheumatically, they had a 7-hour backup window and it's now reduced to 3 hours and they're still trying to get it even quicker. But it's just like, well, I've done it quite a lot for you. Why do you want it? So. All right, I want to just, it's probably going to be coming kind of the next couple of episodes, well, quite long. I've got to get my next Microsoft exam done, my 7412 or 7412. And so I'm basically just started watching my videos for it. So I thought of what I'll do is I wrote notes when I watched the video. So I wanted to just go back over with you guys to see if you understand what I mean. And hopefully I find it this way, it kind of makes me to remember them a lot easier if I kind of try and tell other people about it. So
yeah, I mean, another good way is actually trying to teach people what, you know, what you've just learned. That's what I find anyway.
So before, in the past, I've talking about domains and how every a domain, you've got a domain controller which kind of makes keeps all the stores all the passwords, and it basically keeps all the passwords in sync, and that's where it goes to authenticate. So normally when you create a domain, like let's call our company company.local, that's normally in one domain, and it's normally one domain, one forest. Okay, so if people are driving, all right, don't attempt this, but if you've got a got a paper, if you draw a triangle on a bit of paper, and then that's kind of your that's what we're going to call our one domain. That's what we are at the moment. That's what we're going to call our first. So that little triangle you draw in there is what we call a domain. And inside that, you've got your little computers and your little domain controller. So that, you know, that's your one domain, your single forest, single domain. Let's say that you wanted to have multiple domains. So let's say that you had like a American site or in a UK site, or you wanted it so that you've got like a kind of like a, I don't know, you want to have like a production domain and a development domain. So what you can do is you can create subdomains, okay, or their own child domains, child domains. So that's going to create one underneath that. So underneath your little triangle you've drawn, and if you go, if you get a little corner at the left hand corner, the bottom left hand corner, draw a little triangle underneath it.
Hey, I'm still trying to catch up here. I just realised that this is where we need the pencils, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, hang on. So I've got a triangle with some computers in it.
Yeah. Here's one we made earlier. For American listeners, I don't know if they know that. But,
I don't know if you can see that.
No. Yeah, so underneath that, draw another little triangle in the left-hand bottom corner. And then on the other side of it, draw another triangle in the other right hand. So like, so it looks like you've got one big triangle, but inside that triangle you've got three little triangles.
Oh, I see. I've done it wrong.
So the smaller triangles are inside the big triangle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any clouds anywhere?
Yeah, kind of. So like. This is going to be really bad in the podcast, but I don't know if you can see it. So like that.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's what I did originally.
Oh, I did that originally.
So yeah, so you've got at the top, that's the top domain is called your root domain. That's the root domain you create first, and then underneath that you've got your two child domains. Okay. So if you draw like a circle round that whole those three domains you've got there. Like
kind of reminds me of a 70s TV series, my diagram.
Yeah. So that means that's what you call a forest. So that you see that's multiple domains in one forest.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you draw a line between the two triangles from the one child domain to the root domain, and then on the other domain, draw a line on it as well. So it looks like you know you've got a triangle, but there isn't a line at the bottom connecting them. There we go.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I've got that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. So what you've got is you've got a triangle at the top with a line going down to two little triangles either side of them. So you've got, all of that, that's all together, that's your one big forest you've got in your company. So that top one can be, let's call that company.local. And then your child domain underneath of that, that could be like uk.company.local, and the other one could be us.company.local. But they don't have to be, the child domains don't have to be, though they could be called uk.local and company.local. So the good thing about this is that when you create these subdomains or the child domains, there's those links automatically created between the two, which is a thing called trusts.
Trust relationships.
Yeah, so they're already created, okay? And so that what you can then do is you can then set permissions up that if you wanted to set like resources, so if you've got a printer or a file server in the top domain, you can then add people permissions in to print to or access to those files. Do you see what I mean? So, but if you notice, there's no link between the bottom, but I think it's called transift, TRANSIV,
transitive.
Yeah. Which basically means that because there's a link between the two child domain, if you wanted to, you could, if people in the UK could talk to people in the US, because what would happen, it would go up to the root domain and then down again, so you wouldn't have to create the link between the two the UK and the US domain.
So is this a matter of authentication? So, you know, sort of single sign-on type thing?
Yeah.
You
could, okay. It's not single sign-on, but you set, because obviously the user accounts aren't on the top domain. So let's say your user account's in the UK domain. Obviously that user account isn't in the top domain. It's in the UK domain, not in the root domain, sorry. So what you do, let's say if you had a folder, let's say you had a file server in the top domain, and that's called let's call it fileserver.company.local, okay, and you're in the UK and you're in the uk.local domain. Obviously you have DNS set up all for you automatically, because that's what is what, because it's a all-in-one forest, it does all the DNS for you. So you'd go back to /fileserver.company.local, and it would know that that's in the company domain, so that it would obviously know how to get there. But obviously, it doesn't know about your user account in that domain because you haven't assigned it permissions. But obviously, what you can do is on the, you know, like I've shown you before, where you can go into properties in the file and share stuff, and you can add permissions in. You know, like there's a drop-down box on it. It says domain, and it will say company.local. You can click on browse, and there'll be a list, and it will say in there uk.company.local, and you can select that. And then you can then search for that user, if you see what I mean. Does it make sense?
Yeah, I played around with trust relationships and things back in the Windows 2000 days.
Yeah.
Because I think there was a sort of, I think it was an NT4 domain, and I was trying to get my Windows 2000 servers to talk to it. But really, the IT department were Unix, Linux anyway, so they weren't really interested in what I was trying to do. And I think all they were interested about was, because the Windows 2000 DNS server wanted to do updates to the Linux DNS server, and they wanted to put a stop to it. So I was a bit stuck, really. So yeah, good. I think, but it sounds like it's evolved, or it's almost pretty much the same as it was in those.
So I can go to Trust what Yourtwa do in a minute. But what I would say is, this is all the Trust gate. And if you want to, you can do a thing called a shortcut Trust. So you can see that if you wanted to talk to UK to the US, it'll have to go by the top one and then down again. But obviously, if you've got multiple, you can have as many as you want underneath. So you can get it, so it can be a massive tree. I haven't seen this, but look, you could have like 20 domains in one forest. And obviously, if you wanted to go, if you had one bottom at one domain, and you wanted to speak to the one at the right, the other side, you have to go up like four domains and then down four domains again to get to that domain to authenticate or access the resource. And what you can do is you can do a shortcut trust, which basically you do a little you authenticate, you do in the trust relationship, you can create a manual one, and it will just literally just it will just bypass it all and just do a little shortcut. That's what's called a shortcut trust, basically.
Does it have to go through? So I mean, if these domains are say you don't have redundant links between these servers, if one kind of gets cut out, would that affect it?
Yeah, well, I think it does it multiple domain. If you've got multiple domain controls, it's not a problem. I don't really understand it. It's getting quite complicated past my level, but that's the way it kind of explained it. Kind of thing. Yeah. So I think it has to go up and then down. So, and what you also get is that these you get things called domain level functions and forest level functions. So you can, when you create new servers, like if you create a brand new Winner 2012 domain and forest, it would be at domain level already. But let's say you had 2003 servers and then you two main controls, and then you put 2012 domain controls in your environment, and then you get rid of all your 2003 domain controllers, your forest will be at a certain level. So like it'll be like at the 2003 domain level. And there's things, I'm just going to click on a link to tell you what they are, but you can then you have to before you can raise your forest level up, you have to raise all your lower domains up before you can raise the forest level up. So like with the things that give you, like with 2008 you get DFS stuff, and they can get, you get better encryption, you get recycle bin, AD recycle bin, with the forest level, if you increase the forest functional level. So to get your level up, you have to make sure you've got the right level domain controllers in there. So you make sure you've got, so if you're doing all your 2012 R2 domain controllers all up in your domain, you then have to upgrade your domain, each of your domains you've got up to the highest level that can be. Once you've got everyone up to the same domain level, you can then do the forest level. But what you've got to remember is that you can't roll back after you've done your domain or forest level upgrade. It's like a one-way street, you can't go back. So like certain things that if you, like certain clients aren't supported if you do certain domain level, if you say what I mean.
Something that a sort of distributed company might,
yeah, if you got
use.
Multi, if you don't trust your admins as well, it's also a good thing if you don't want to give your domain admins access to all your networking. Like, so if you've got American one, you can say, right, I only want the Americans to look after this domain, but I don't want them to have power over my root domain or my UK domain.
Yeah, so you can compartmentalise.
Yes. So everyone's got domains, they've got domain access, but they've only got domain admin rights, but they've only got it to their own little domain. So what you can also do is that, let's say if you've got two companies come together, they're going to have separate Active Directory domains, and how does that work? How do you integrate those domains together? Well, you do a thing called a manual trust. So if you think, what you can do is, if you draw like a little diagram again, just do it on the left hand side of, or the right hand side of it, draw your three little triangles again. If you, at the top, you can draw a line between the two, and then that's called, you can create a trust that way. So, and the trust can be either way. So you could have it so that you can only trust one way, or it can be by direct call trusts. So you've got trusting domain. So the trusting domain is content resource you want to allow access to, and the trusted domain is the contains the security principles to which you want to grant access. So the trusted domain, trusting domain, is where you want the resources you want to access, and the trusted domain is where your users are sitting. So, but most people just do it both ways, so that it'll be two ways, so that you can access resources both ways. So to get that to work, you basically need DNS working between the two servers. So you might want to do some forwarding. So like, let's say your company.locals is one company, the abc.locals the other company. Obviously, if you don't add in like a conditional forwarder, or maybe a secondary DNS, so like a secondary DNS server to the primary DNS server, there's like, you need to be able to resolve it, if you see what I mean. So if you go, so you need to be able to ping abc.local from either side, obviously, to name resolution it, if you see what I mean.
So in this triangle, would you have to have VPNs set up between the two?
Yeah, you'd have to have some sort of networking between the two level, between the two sites for it to work.
But only from these user triangles, from the small to the big triangle.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do it between the two small triangles, because that would take the authentication out.
Yeah. Okay. So that's quite interesting. So what you've got there is you've got a thing called you need to get to, there's a thing called domains to get to, I can't think what it's called now. AD. So I think where you go to add a domain. I know if you go on the computer, you think it's called trust or something, trust and relationship. It'll be a long day today. I'm not used to all this driving now. I work from home.
So DC promo was.
That's when you want to create a new domain controller. So I don't think what it's called now. The snap-in you go to. Yeah, Active Directory Domain and Trust Console. You go into to go into adding the trust. So make sure you've got a DNS that's working between the two. So if you from one of the PCs, from one of the DCs, go ping the other one and make sure that it resolves a domain controller. There's actually a good little command you can run called I haven't known about this command. I'll put it in the show notes. It's called nltest, and the / /dsgetdc and the domain name of what you're trying to do, so abc.local. And you click return, and it basically goes off and does a DNS check. Tells you what DC is on the other side, and it will tell you what that DC's got, if it's a PDC, a GC, an LDP, a KDC. Yeah, so it's another little tool in your arsenal to check the DC is, basically, make sure it's all working. So yeah, that's really what I want to talk about. I don't really go much more than the sites, and I want to talk about sites and services next, which is an interesting topic. Is like it's how if local workstations find their domain controllers, and if you wanted to how the replications work, like Andy, you were talking about having links between sites. Well, you might have a link if you've got a server as an office in India. They might not have a great link. And the problem is, as you do those Active Directory changes, it will sync them between the domain controllers. And if you only got a slow link, it will obviously fill those links up. So we'll go over that next time. Has anyone else got anything interesting to talk about? Or if anyone's got anything, we'll just wrap up, I'm guessing. So, a couple of people have come and joined our Google Plus the last couple of days, so that's good. So that's good. And we also, me and Jerry, were on the HPR episode, what came out last week, so that's quite good with our experience of OddCamp. So
yeah, looking forward to next year. I was going to say, I think one of the people that joined the Google Plus page was me as well, so there you go.
Good. All right, then. Well, it's always you can email us at mail@abandonpodcast.co.uk, or you can email us at our names at abandonpodcast.co.uk. And I must remember to add Jerry to our mailing list so he can get our emails if anyone emails in.
Please do.
Yeah, we can split all that up. That's no problem. And if anyone hasn't added the Google Plus page, they can go and add that as well. So is that it for today?
Yeah, well, I was going to say about a competition. I want to get some T-shirts done, the Admin podcast T-shirts, just because you can. I wanted to kind of promote our site. So if people, I was going to kind of do a bit of a, anyone got any ideas of how we can promote the site that has emailed in? Maybe I was just wondering if we could get the person who kind of promotes the site the most or gets the most retweets or something or the most shares or something will win a T-shirt. So people get thinking of where, what I think, does people want us to have a Facebook page or a Twitter page? What is the best way to keep us in, trying to promote the site, really?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways, isn't there? Yeah, I mean, word of mouth is one of them. Yeah, of course, yeah. But you know, Google Plus. Well, we already do that. Facebook page, Twitter page. You know, but yeah. So if anyone has any suggestions or just shares the page enough or
cool. All right. Well, annoyingly, I was looking at Twitter. You can't have admin podcast because it's too long. So I don't know how we're going to do that. So we could have the AA podcast, but that sounds like we're the Alcoholics Anonymous podcast
or the Automobile Association.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be the AAA, no, the AA the AAP.
The AAP, isn't that something like Associated Press, the American Associated Press or something?
We could be the admin PCast. That's another option.
Good. All right, guys, we'll see you all next week.
All right, bye now.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.